It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at the news this week that Hillary Clinton used a personal email account for government business while Secretary of State.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of state news with news guy Noah Ofshinsky.
The state assembly took up right-to-work legislation this week and took part in a marathon session debating the bill before passing it this morning. Along with right-to-work, Governor Walker also threw his support behind a new bill restricting abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy.
And we're joined now by WPR Assistant News Director Noah Ofshinsky, who joins us every week to review the state's top news stories. Noah, welcome back.
It is good to be here. Good afternoon and happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Well, lots of big legislation. It's been a big week in Wisconsin, legislation moving forward. Noah, the right-to-work bill, we heard that it passed this morning. Catch us up on what happened.
So after 24 hours of impassioned debate, the state assembly passed right-to-work on a party-line vote at around 9 o'clock this morning. Once the governor signs this bill, Wisconsin's going to be officially become the 25th state to have right-to-work bills. The governor's expected to sign it on Monday.
So as you said, 24 hours of debate,
yes.
A lot of opportunity for things to get a little hairy, for people to get fried. But what was the tone like?
Obviously, people were very passionate about this issue. And the tone really ranged from the quite personal, with one assembly member talking about his father, who was a garbage man. That particular lawmaker argued that right to work and unions could coexist. The tone at times also veered into the humorous and at times included I would say took on more of an insulting tone, I would say.
Obviously, no agreement between Republicans and Democrats on exactly how right to work will affect Wisconsin economically and otherwise, but what did supporters say?
So Republicans who pushed for the bill repeatedly argued this was about freedom and the right of individual workers to choose whether to join a union or pay dues at their place of employment, as the case may be. Here is Delafield Republican Chris Kapinga.
It's the freedom of the individual that is most important. Let them make the choice if they want to be part of this union or not. We don't care if they do. We don't care if they don't. We care if they have the choice. Let the workers make that choice, the individual worker.
And supporters also say that this will make the state more attractive to companies looking to expand or relocate to Wisconsin.
Okay, and those are the supporters. How about critics, and in this case, mostly Democrats?
Right. So Democrats and unions made several arguments over the course of this, I would say, fast-track debate. Democrats in the assembly said the bill would lead to labor unrest because union members would, probably at some point grow to resent those who don't pay union dues if they work in the same, same business. They also argued that this will lead to lower wages, across the board. The other big theme among the critics, at least, dealt with this bill, the bill's timing, really, because this is all happening in the context of Governor Walker, his possible presidential run, and what part this legislation may be playing in his possible campaign. Here is Racine Democrat Corey Mason on that issue.
Unfortunately, it's the workers in this state that are suffering through the politics of our governor's ambitions. And I will ask today, I hope that no more of Wisconsin's middle class has to be sacrificed on the altar of Scott Walker's presidential ambitions.
And again, that bill expected to be signed into law come Monday morning.
Yeah, Monday, just outside Milwaukee.
So from a bill that's moved through the legislature to a bill that is reportedly still being written, there's some momentum building for a new abortion bill. What's the latest?
Right. So this, I have to say, sort of came out of nowhere, at least for me. In an open letter published earlier this week, Governor Walker wrote that he would sign a bill that would ban abortions after 20 weeks here in the state. Now, one of the reasons why this came as something of a surprise is in the past, the governor has been, vague or basically noncommittal about this kind of legislation. But after being criticized by national conservative leaders earlier this week, his stance obviously on the issue changed, and he wrote this open letter.
So why are the governor and his supporters in the legislature looking for this bill right now?
Well, Senate President Mary Lozick, who said yesterday that she will actually be the lead sponsor of this bill, says that abortions after 20 weeks cause pain to the baby. That was her main argument.
And to be clear, there's no consensus on this point of pain.
Yeah, no, the view in the science world, it's very controversial. There isn't a lot of very definitive science out there that says one way or the other, but the vast majority of scientists who study this thing say that fetuses, you know, don't feel pain till at least the beginning of the third trimester, which is, of course, is later than 20 weeks.
And how many states already have this kind of law?
12 states have this kind of law on the books. In two states, at least, the laws are currently in limbo because they are being challenged in court.
How does this coming bill fit into the big picture nationally on abortion?
Right. So if you take a step back and look at it from a national perspective, you see this kind of ban as the latest effort by pro-life groups to further restrict access to abortions at the state level, not at the national level, but at the state level. And as you might remember, we've talked about on this show, there's another law that's being passed elsewhere and is currently being challenged here in court in Wisconsin that requires abortion providers to have admitting privileges at local hospitals. And these two pieces of legislation have been slowly making their way sort of across the country and with legislators that are receptive to this kind of laws. They're passing them, again, as a means of, again, making it harder and really shrinking the access that women have to abortion services.
Well, lastly, we're going to turn to the presidential campaign of a candidate who's not actually said he's running for president. That campaign continues. What's Governor Walker doing this weekend?
Right. So Governor Walker is heading to the Iowa Agriculture Summit in Des Moines this weekend. He will be joined by other presidential hopefuls, familiar list of folks, Jeb Bush, Rick Perry, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and others.
Why Iowa?
Well, Iowa is a crucial state. The Iowa caucuses are really the first contest in the primary season. And, you know, you'll see a lot of Governor Walker going there and other presidential hopefuls. You know, obviously, I think any presidential candidate would love to win Iowa, you know, because that adds a lot of momentum to their campaign at a very crucial time.
To be continued.
Absolutely.
All right, Noah, thanks a lot for stopping by.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
That was WPR's Assistant News Director, Noah Ovshinsky, reviewing the biggest stories from around the state in our Wisconsin News Roundup.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
News that Hillary Clinton exclusively used a personal email account for government business while at the State Department made its rounds this week. It was first reported by the New York Times on Monday, and on Wednesday, Clinton asked the State Department to release her emails to the public.
Clinton critics have suggested that the personal email account could have allowed her to keep certain emails out of federal records, particularly pertaining to possible Clinton Foundation fundraising from foreign governments or the terrorist attack in Benghazi.
There was no actual requirement that Clinton use a government email address, apparently, while she was in office, and a Hillary Clinton defense group, Correct the Record, has said that John Kerry is the first Secretary of State to rely primarily on a government email account. Gabriel De Benedetti is a Politico reporter. He's here to give us the latest. Gabriel, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
So this week, a State Department spokesperson said there was not then and there is not now a prohibition on using a personal email for official business. No time requirement when she was serving for those needed to be preserved as records. They've been preserved now. So on the face of this, has Hillary Clinton done anything legally wrong?
Not as far as we can tell, but there are still major questions. It's not entirely clear yet, but there were State Department guidelines suggesting that officials should not be using their personal email address. And on that front, at least, Secretary Clinton clearly crossed that line. But as to whether she did anything illegal, I think the jury is still out on that one, though her team says certainly not.
And a lot of people who are involved in things like archiving and government transparency and that sort of thing say this is pretty unusual to use exclusively a personal email account. That's more of an occasional thing at most. Does that seem to be the consensus?
That is the consensus, but they do caution that it is the protocol and the precedent for secretaries of state. Clinton's people, as you mentioned, have said over and over that John Kerry is the first secretary of state to exclusively rely on his official account, and they point to the fact that Colin Powell, a Republican secretary of state, had also relied on a personal email address.
Now, we've heard from Republican critics on this, one House committee subpoenaing some of these emails. What have Republicans been saying about this email situation?
Well, they're basically using it as an opportunity to paint Clinton as untrustworthy, not particularly committed to transparency and, you know, altogether opaque before she decides to run for president. Now, she's expected to launch her campaign in the coming weeks, and Republicans are looking for ways to bring her down. It's sort of an expected line of attack that Clinton is not as transparent and as clean as she says she really is.
And Clinton, as we mentioned, is turning over emails. The State Department is going through them, seeing what can be released, what might be confidential. But there's been some criticism that it's Clinton's staff deciding what material to turn over to the State Department. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. The Clinton team said that it handed over 55,000 printed pages of emails, but they decided which emails to hand over. They say that it's the vast majority of the emails that she sent, and that the ones that they didn't include were personal emails. And, you know, those don't necessarily need to go to the State Department. But on the other hand, critics rightly point out that, well, how can we trust that these are all the emails that are pertinent? And how can we trust that the Clinton team hasn't, you know, conveniently decided not to disclose some of the more damning emails?
So this might be for the courts to decide ultimately, but does it seem like the House committee investigating what happened in Benghazi could gain access to all of the emails on that account as they look for material related to their investigation?
It's not entirely clear yet what degree of transparency there will be here and how many of the emails that particular committee will get. They will certainly see the emails that pertain specifically to Benghazi, and the State Department says that it will release all of the emails once that at least it can release once they've reviewed it all. So we will expect to see all of these emails. The thing is that it might take quite some time, and both John Kerry and his spokesperson said, don't expect to see these anytime soon because we still have to go through them and review them.
Now, one of the concerns here is about security, as we've seen again and again in the last year. This is a very hackable world. A server under control of then Secretary Clinton off of a government site, evidently not under government control. Are there concerns that important information could have been hacked and leaked?
Major concerns, but there's no real answer to this yet. There is a general belief that her private server was not necessarily as secure as the State Department server, which, of course, has had problems of its own. But there is a real security concern, because if it's out of the control of the government entirely, how can they be sure that it is not totally vulnerable to hacking? That said, the Clinton pushback to this line of argument is, well, wait a minute, the State Department knew about this. This is not necessarily something that is a total surprise to them. So they knew that this was happening. They knew that this is how she was emailing and how she was communicating. They wouldn't have allowed her to do it if they knew that it was totally insecure. At least that's the Clinton line.
Now, this is a top cabinet position. It seems like what we're learning about here is kind of an ad hoc system when it comes to potentially sensitive emails. Were you surprised that there weren't more formal procedures and policies and security precautions in place?
I think it's safe to say that there was a very big degree of surprise in Washington and in New York and the other official circles after this came out. Really, no one was expecting that this was the case. It does seem that there is, again, a precedent here that top-level officials may have been using their personal accounts, but that's certainly not the case for most officials in the administration or in the government more generally speaking. So there was definitely a degree of surprise.
Is there a reason or has a reason been offered as to why a top-level government official would want to use a personal email system versus their formal, you know, at US.gov or whatever the official one might be?
There has not been one good reason for that, but it is important to note that Clinton never got a personal Senate, or never got, rather, a State Department email address because she had this other one set up for her. So it's not that she opted out, she just never had it in the first place, although she could have if she wanted to. But a good reason has not been offered other than, well, she had this personal address and she continued to use this personal address. The State Department knew about it and they knew that they would get whatever emails they needed to get from her. So the Clinton people basically say, well, why not?
Now, in a piece you wrote just in the last day or so, you talked to a lot of Democrats around the country, some in Iowa, the early caucus state. And one theme that seemed to come up is, maybe this isn't a big deal, but if it is or something like it is, Hillary Clinton's campaign is in trouble and she's really all we've got. How big a worry is this for Democrats?
It's a huge worry for Democrats. Democrats, as you rightly pointed out, are not running from her in any stretch of the imagination. They are very much behind her candidacy and want to stress, basically universally, they want her to be the nominee and they want her to be the president. However, there is a large degree of worry because they look around and they see basically nothing beyond her. There are other people that are making noise about running for president, such as former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley or Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Some people even think that Vice President Joe Biden might jump in. But these aren't necessarily people that are the biggest names or that have the best shot at taking on a top-level Republican opponent. So Democrats are getting nervous because they say, well, this is kind of an unforced error, Team Clinton. If more of this stuff is coming, we should know about it in advance because there's no one else we can turn to right now.
Now, in the world of people who talk about politics, one of the criticisms of the Clinton non-campaign at this point is they're not in high gear yet. They're not up to speed. They're not ready to deal with these things. And Republicans are certainly looking for these kind of things in advance of the campaign. Is there an unreadiness for potential presidential candidate Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, she's in an awkward situation because at this moment, all she said is that she's considering running. It's pretty clear to everyone involved that she is running and that she'll probably launch a campaign in the coming weeks. But she's technically still a private citizen, so she does not have a big political staff that can help her out right now. There are plenty of people waiting in the wings that are waiting for that first paycheck, but they're not technically on Team Clinton yet. And as a private citizen, she can't ask for their help. So she's in this difficult situation where she has a small personal staff that's dealing with this, but they can't really coordinate to the full degree with the State Department or the White House as they would if she were still a public official.
In your roundup of Democrats, were there any who were critical of Clinton, either for the handling of the email itself or for not being able to respond to the perception that it might create?
Absolutely. A lot of people had serious questions about it. The place that they stopped for the vast majority of them was saying that this email brewing scandal was enough to turn them off of her, turn her off to them completely. They still support her broadly, but a lot of people had serious questions about it because a lot of these questions are not very easy to answer. Why would you only rely on your personal email? Does that show some bad judgment? And how could you not know that these stories were coming?
Have laws and policy changed, getting back to the federal level here, to make it more clear, more strict as to where your email goes if you're the Secretary of State?
It's not entirely clear, and this is one of the areas where people are really digging hard right now. But it does seem clear that under John Kerry, the current Secretary of State, the only one since Clinton, all professional business is being done on official accounts. So he's certainly in compliance with whatever federal regulations there are, but we can expect to see lots of lawsuits, lots of questions about Secretary Clinton's use of email, which is sort of an open question at this point.
Are there other comparable scandals or debates in presidential races, past or present, that you would compare this particular situation to?
This is sort of there are certainly scandals that are similar. But this one is in a sort of unique situation because Clinton is at the beginning of her race, before it's even started. One analogy that's been used, though, is Mitt Romney's tax return in 2012, when Democrats over and over demanded that he hand over his tax returns to show what a low tax rate he presumably had. And he finally did that in September of 2012, but by then it was way too late. Democrats had already portrayed him as a sort of out-of-touch plutocrat. Republicans are kind of hoping that this is the same deal, that they can continue and continue and continue to demand that Clinton release her emails, because even once the State Department does it, there will be more emails to release because her team didn't hand over all the emails to the State Department. So Republicans are hoping that they can make this issue into one that really paints a broader picture of Clinton in a similar way to the tax returns did to Romney.
Is this a thing where Clinton and her people could maybe make this go away faster by at least appearing to get out ahead of it, release as much as can realistically be released?
It seems highly unlikely that that was going to happen at this point because Clinton has said that she's asked the State Department to review the emails before releasing them. She can ask the State Department to really hurry up here, but the State Department's not going to want to release these emails until they really review all of them and make sure that they wouldn't be releasing any confidential information. A big problem that Jeb Bush had a few weeks back was when he released all of his emails from his time as Florida governor, or at least a good amount of them, he didn't redact them fully. So some Floridian social security numbers and personal information were online. You can imagine what would happen if the State Department did something like that, but it would be even worse because it would include some secret national security information.
Is this the wave of the future? Politicians are going to be tripped up on this ever-changing technology when they're in office or when they're not?
Short answer is yes. We never know. You know, technology is changing by the second, and it's just a matter of time until someone's running for office and their campaign is derailed because of some old pictures that are on Facebook or something like that. Email, we have to keep in mind, was very well established in 2009 when Clinton took over as Secretary of State. But the use of it has changed pretty drastically since then, and presumably it will change a lot more in the next 6 years.
Gabriel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Politico reporter Gabriel DiBenedetti talking about the news this week that Hillary Clinton used a personal email account to conduct government business instead of a government email account during her time as Secretary of State.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrath. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Starting at sundown tonight, the National Day of Unplugging begins. It's an effort from the organization Reboot to get people to turn off their phones, focus on the people around them, and try to take stock of how technology use is affecting others.
Tanya Shevitz joins us now. She's National Communications Manager for Reboot and the National Day of Unplugging. Tanya, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Tanya, why do we need a National Day of Unplugging?
Well, I think it's kind of the one day a year to get the message out that we have reached a tipping point in our use of digital devices and really need to bring our lives back into balance. So on this one day, we ask people to put down their devices for 24 hours or as long as they can do it. We just ask people to make an effort and to try to reconnect with the people around them, reconnect with themselves and the community. But this is definitely not a one-off. We want people to continue. This is the one day to get the message out.
So you're hoping that this could be habit-forming, not that we'll, you know, toss our technology in the garbage, but that we'll appreciate the time away from it.
Right, exactly. I mean, we're not at all anti-technology. We certainly use technology to get the word out about the National Day of Unplugging. But it's just that people have kind of reached, they're overwhelmed with the constant deluge of technology that's coming at you all the time. So certainly we're not saying throw it out. It's just saying take a pause and focus on the people around you. I mean, gosh, kids today feel like they're second in importance to their parents' digital devices. It's become mommy, me, and the phone.
A day can seem like a long time to someone who's really invested, who spends a lot of time on their technology and their devices. Is it reasonable to start off with a whole day like that?
Well, you know, we really do say it's open to your interpretation. I mean, if you can do 24 hours, that is wonderful. But it's just a message to take achievable steps, you know. So if you just do, you know, a family dinner unplugged on the National Day of Unplugging, or you take 2 hours and you play some board games with your kids, or you sit down and have a glass of wine with your spouse or partner and literally put away the cell phone, shut it off, put it in another room, and spend that time without the binging, beeping, ringing, and vibration, that's a great step. And maybe, you know, people will continue. Maybe they'll become addicted to that. You know, I really encourage people to do it in a way that works for them so that they see the benefit. So for me, I always unplug on the National Day of Unplugging for the 24 hours. But the rest of the year, I unplug every day when I pick my kids up from school. I mean, of course, there are going to be exceptions. There are always, like today, the National Day of Unplugging when it's really intense. But I'll be unplugging at sundown. So that's what's most important for me. When I pick my kids up from school, sending them the message that you're the most important thing, and I want to hear what happened at school. I want to talk to you. I want to play with basketball with you in the backyard, and I don't want this device getting in the way all the time.
So what's the reaction when you talk to people about this idea? They are excited, they see the need for it, or are they kind of horrified and shocked at the very notion?
Well, people definitely are horrified and shocked at first. You know, I mean, they're like, what? I can't do that. But, you know, once they start talking about it. They recognize that they do actually crave a break and that it would be nice. And, you know, no one likes to be at dinner with a friend or a partner who has the phone out and is completely ignoring them. So I think I usually start out when I talk with people, with groups in particular, I start out with the question, who here has been ignored by someone on a cell phone? Everyone raises their hand. Who here has ignored people when you've been on your cell phone? Everyone raises their hand. We're all in it together. And so the idea is really taking that time, thinking about your use and where you really should, you know, take a break. But of course, people are addicted. You feel the phantom buzzing when you don't have your phone. And it's hard for me. I'm the spokesperson for the National Debt Unplugging, and I think about my phone when it's away. But it's just about making a real effort.
Well, Jimmy Kimmel joked about this idea. He said, sure, spend a day relaxing without your technology, and the next day answering 500 texts from your mom explaining that you're not dead. So do we need to prepare people in advance if we're going to unplug?
Yes, absolutely. Oh, my gosh. I mean, there was this story, I think, last year of a college student who went off of Facebook and her roommate, like, I think alerted police, thought she was dead or missing, had been kidnapped. You know, I mean, if you disappear just without any notice, people are going to wonder what happened to you. So it really is about letting people know. I mean, certainly if you're going to do 24 hours, you for sure should call your mom before and tell her you're going to be offline. But it's also just letting people know, like, hey, I'm going to be unplugged during a certain time, or I'm not going to be reachable. Just setting the expectation. I mean, unfortunately, there's an expectation in society right now that we will respond immediately to everything. And I think that it's retraining ourselves not to have that impulse and retraining the people around us and setting some boundaries. But absolutely, let people know. Put it out on your Facebook. You know, put it in your email response so that people, if they email you, they know that you're offline.
I understand that some people approach the National Day of Unplugging by taking a pledge to do it. Does that make them more likely to follow through on the whole day without technology?
Well, I think it does because it reminds them of all the great things they can do when they're unplugged. I was actually at an event last night where I took 100 photos of these photos that are on our website. As you referenced, there are photos that people say, I unplug too, and they fill in the blank. And people were coming up with all sorts of things. I unplug to create. I unplug to paint. I unplug to sing. I unplug to connect. And so it's when people take that moment to think about it, then they really realize there's so much more out there than that little screen. And so that really helps, you know. And it also helps to set up things to do. And we have people, partners all over the world. Here in San Francisco, we partnered with the San Francisco Rec and Park Department, and all their activities tomorrow are unplugged activities. And they're encouraging people to get out and play and do art and do Zumba and do baseball. There's yoga, that type of thing. Billings, Montana has a whole host of events all day, unplugged events. So it helps to have things to do. If you unplug and you just sit home alone, you know, that cell phone is going to be calling to you.
Well, you're looking at the front end of this. You're hoping people are on board. They're going to do this thing for at least part of the day. But what do you hear afterwards, after the 24 hours? What do people tell you?
Well, you know, we hear a variety of things. Of course, people are like, oh, my gosh, that was so hard. But we also hear about their incredible experiences, you know, that they had conversations that they wouldn't have had. We had an unplugged party a few years ago at South by Southwest Interactive, which is probably the most plugged-in place in the world, you know, at that period. And we had a party where we invited people to come in, stash their cell phones in the cell phone sleeping bags that we have, and have an unplugged time. And this woman came out afterward and said, wow, you know, my friends and I had conversations that we never would have had if we had had our cell phones. Because so often you're in a conversation and the other person is texting someone else or scrolling through Facebook, you know, I mean, just kind of mindless scrolling through the phone, which happens so often and is so easy to fall into. So we really hear from people that they have an incredible experience, that they've connected with people. They talk to strangers. Can you imagine that? Like actually striking up a conversation with someone in line or on the street. And that's just great to see and hear.
We're talking about the National Day of Unplugging. It starts at sundown tonight and goes until sundown tomorrow. Tanya Shevitz is with us. She's the National Communications Manager for Reboot and for National Day of Unplugging.
And we want to hear what you think of this. Be honest. Do you need this National Day of Unplugging? Do you think getting through 24 hours without, say, the phone, the tablet would be hard? Do you think you can get your family and friends to buy in? Or do you think technology is just part of how we live now and it's okay if we use it a lot? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or, ironically, post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll get to your calls in a bit. First, here's a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about turning off our devices, getting reacquainted with the people around us, and, I don't know, reading a book or something for National Day of Unplugging. That begins at sunset tonight and goes until sunset tomorrow.
And we'd love to hear your take on this. What do you think? Are you up for a National Day of Unplugging? Can you make it from tonight, when it gets dark, you've still got a little bit of time left, through tomorrow night when the sun goes down? Do you think your family would be on board with this? And do you have plans for how you might try to spend that time and reconnect with the people around you? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Go right to our callers. We've got Christopher in Galena, Illinois with us now. Christopher, hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for an amazing show. I really appreciate it, and I love the topic. I'm an adjunct professor at the University of Dubuque, and I taught a class that was basically communication arts this year, but I dedicated the whole J term to making a human connection, and that involves stepping away from technology so you're not distracted and actually making a true resonating connection. And I can't tell you how difficult it was for my students to actually put their phones away, not just in class, but I made them do this exercise for a day. I had no way of tracking, of course, if they followed through with it. But the reality is it profoundly changed them over the couple weeks, and they had remarkable things to say about the connections that they made when they weren't distracted. So I really applaud this type of effort. I think it's really crucial in a time that we're so plugged in for people to really go back and remember that some of the best things we have going for us are the things we're missing based on technology.
Christopher, thanks a lot for that call. We'll bring our guest back in, Tanya Shevitz, with the National Day of Unplugging. Tanya, he's teaching unplugging.
That's wonderful to hear, and I've heard it actually from more and more professors around the country. We have a professor that we've partnered with in New York, Jennifer Rausch, who teaches a similar class and has had her students unplug, and she actually took 184 days unplugged herself. And I think it is really powerful for them to experience that. There was a school here in San Francisco, Sacred Heart, that had their kids put their teens put their cell phones in sealed envelopes with an actual seal that you could tell if they broke it. So that's a tip for you there to see if they actually do it. And the kids said that they had incredible experiences and connected so well with their parents and their peers.
Well, thanks a lot, Christopher. Appreciate that call. And we'll go next to Dennis in Oshkosh. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Personally, I could go forever without a cell phone or a smartphone myself. I hate being thought of that I'm on call constantly, and my wife absolutely hates that I sneak out of the house without my phone once in a while, but I don't need to be on call. Or, you know, then you do get the questions, well, where were you? Why didn't you answer your phone? Well, I don't have my phone. I forgot it.
Thanks a lot, Dennis. Appreciate your perspective. And Tanya, I notice this happens on a Friday night to a Saturday night and not during the work week. Is there something to that where, you know, maybe we're not quite ready to decouple from all the work that we do with our devices yet?
Yes. Well, there are a couple of reasons it's Friday night to Saturday night. So this is rooted in the tradition, the ancient tradition of the Sabbath and the day of rest. But it's a recognition that everyone needs this, not the Jews. I mean, this is like, you know, a profound problem worldwide now. But of course, I mean, geez, we're all, we have to be, pretty much have to be connected for work. I think it would be pretty hard to ask people to unplug during the work week. We're really saying, you know, unplug when you're around the people who are the most important to you, and reconnect with them. And, you know, I mean, studies have shown that kids that were sent away to camp without digital devices for 5 days, in comparison to the kids who were at home, they could read social cues and facial expressions much better after just 5 days. So just taking a break, you know, a regular break from technology, I think can have a profound effect. But absolutely, I think it's a little much to ask people to unplug during the work week. I think maybe, you know, unplug during your lunch to give yourself a break and maybe talk to your colleagues. But that's why it is on the weekend for sure.
Talking to Tanya Shevitz about the National Day of Unplugging, running from sundown tonight to sundown tomorrow, a chance to put away the phones and connect with people. Lines have opened up now at 800-642-1234. If you want to join with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. We've got Jenny on the line with us now in Deerfield. Jenny, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I actually did not know about this National Day of Unplugging, and I think it is an amazing idea. I know it's going to be very difficult for me to do it. I plan on doing it, but I think we need to have more of these throughout the year as our dependence on technology grows, especially with the younger people. I think it's very important to remember that if we suddenly didn't have technology or if something drastic happens, I mean, you're not going to know how to socially interact as well if you're not really spending time and getting to know people.
So, Jenny, if you take the day off tonight, tomorrow night, what are you going to do? What are you going to do with the time that you would have been spending looking at a screen?
Well, I'm planning on trying to actually read some books that I've been meaning to read, spend time with my one-year-old son and actually play a lot with him instead of just letting him play and sit on my phone. And I don't know, just try and catch up with people that I live near and, yeah, just try to have a fulfilling day without any sort of phone or computer.
Sounds like a great plan, Jenny. Tanya, write exactly the sort of thing you're looking for.
Oh, my gosh, that just sounds wonderful, especially what she said about connecting with her child. I mean, I just was at my son's school today, Children's Day School in San Francisco, and talking with kids. And I first spoke with the entire assembly, all the parents and the kids, and I offered them cell phone sleeping bags. And all these little kids, you know, like second, third, even first graders came up to me and said, can I have these for my parents? And they went over and handed them to their parents. So often you're hearing from kids that they really feel ignored. I mean, just look around the playground and there are kids. You know, last week, my son and I were at the playground and we saw two moms with their babies in the baby swings and they were both standing next to each other on their cell phones, not pushing the kids. And it's just heartbreaking. And you know what? We're all going to be there sometime. We all are going to fall. And sometimes you'll be on your phone or maybe there is something you actually have to respond to. But it's just being more aware and trying to take those breaks. So I applaud her for being mindful and saying that we need it around the year, not just this one day, because that's what we hope.
Tanya, you've done this before, and you said when you pick up your kids, you turn off the phone. But how has it been for you, especially these 24-hour longer times?
Yeah, so, well, the National Day of Unplugging, it certainly is a challenge, and you have to prepare yourself. I found myself last year getting completely lost because I didn't have my Google app, and I was coming from an unfamiliar place to take my son to Taekwondo. And then we were running late because we were so lost. I couldn't call my husband to tell him that we were going to be late, so we couldn't pick him up. So it's good to prepare yourself, you know, print out maps, make plans ahead of time with people who you're going to meet up with. You know, I mean, this is how we survived back in the old days, you know, when we didn't have the cell phones. You had to actually plan ahead and not just wait to text at the last second. So I would say plan ahead. You know, I would say that when I pick my kids up from school, it's not so hard. I do have this nervousness like, oh gosh, is something coming in from work? I've really trained myself the social part. I just respond to my friends after the kids are in bed at night, you know, after 9 o'clock. But the work thing, I get nervous. Did something come in? But, you know, I would say 99% of the time, there wasn't anything that I had to respond to. So it's training ourselves.
Tanya, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line who said she was going to do this for her kids, but not for herself. So she wasn't going to take the time off, going to make the kids do it. Do you think it's important, though, for parents to participate, to set an example for the kids in the first place?
I think that's the most important message here, actually, because the message we're sending to our kids right now is that it's appropriate to be on our devices all the time. And how can you, I applaud her for trying to unplug her kids, but she should really take the time to unplug herself. And I'm not saying for the entire 24 hours, but at least to show them that it is important to reconnect face-to-face. And maybe she is already doing that, but she's just going to, you know, they're too plugged in. But I do think that the message to our kids has to come from us, and we have to model the behavior.
Well, thank you for that advice about modeling. And for kids, is it important not just to unplug, but to talk about why you're doing it, to give them a little bit of context to dig into?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think a conversation is really important, both for both sides, for the parents and the kids. When I spoke with middle schoolers today, you know, they were all talking about how they feel ignored by their parents when they come home from school. They get the hand like, oh, just a minute, you know, I'm busy on the computer, I'm busy on my phone. And I said, it's really important to talk with your parents about how you feel, but also, you know, look at your own use. It was interesting to hear, though, that all the parents seem to control the kids' technology, because I asked them, but none of the parents seem to control theirs. So I think starting with a conversation at dinner or over a game and saying, like, this is why it's important. How do you feel? How are you feeling when I'm on my devices? How do I feel when you're on the iPad playing, you know, Temple Run or whatever? So a conversation is a vital part of this.
Well, Tanya, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I would encourage people to upload their I Unplug 2 signs to our nationaldayofunplugging.com website to tell us how they like to unplug, and go on our Facebook page, Sabbath Manifesto, to tell us how their experience was.
Tanya Shevitz is National Communications Manager for Reboot and the National Day of Unplugging. It starts tonight at sundown.
There's been a mixed reaction from people in northwestern Wisconsin about the closure of GTAC's office in Hurley. Some say the mining company would have brought much-needed jobs. Others fear the mine would have ruined the environment or their way of life. Danielle Kading reports.
Drivers are making their way down Hurley's snow-covered Silver Street. Iron County Development Zone Director Kelly Klein says abundant snowfall keeps tourists coming back, but it's a trek. He says being tucked back in the Northwoods both draws people in and drives them away. Around 7,830 people lived in Iron County before the last iron ore shipment left Hurley 50 years ago. The county has lost a quarter of its population since then. Klein says GTAC may have changed that.
We rely heavily on the tourism industry and the wood products industry. Those are both very good to us, but adding mining into the mix, I think, would have helped stabilize the population loss. So, yeah, I was disappointed.
And he's not the only one. Sharon Ofsted owns Sharon's Coffee Company in Hurley. Ofsted says it's a loss for families in the area.
There's people that actually want to raise their children here, and that's why we choose to stay here. You know, it's just not all fun and recreation here, and it's sad because there's so many people that are struggling. I mean, making minimum wage, and it's an opportunity that would have helped this whole area.
People in Ashland and Iron Counties may be split over GTAC's plan to mine there, but they agree steady employment is difficult to find, with some working several part-time jobs to make ends meet. Still, Rob Garrington of Ashland says GTAC's decision is a step in the right direction.
I was glad to hear it. I don't want to see the mine. I think for what we would gain from it, it's not worth it for what it's going to do to the environment.
Britton Doolittle of Mason agrees there has to be another way.
And I hope that, you know, the counties can come together and try to figure out a way to sustain people and employment. I don't feel like that was the answer. I just felt like it was a band-aid on an issue that needs to be addressed and how we can create jobs.
Iron County's Kelly Klein says they've had success supporting existing businesses and helping them expand. He says they're also looking at increasing broadband coverage as a means to create jobs. Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins says rural broadband, forestry management, renewable energy, and sustainable agriculture are a few options to explore.
When we start talking about those types of things, we're talking job creation that has nothing to do with mining and has everything to do with creating a better home for our children.
Wiggins is cautiously optimistic GTAC won't move forward with the mine. In the meantime, he says the tribe will continue efforts to protect the lake and tribe by examining what impact a future mine could have on the environment. Hurley's Eli Lipsky says he understands people's concerns, but he's disappointed.
I do feel pretty confident the EPA and the government in the state of Wisconsin would have kept it in check and not allowed any environmental damage beyond what would be repairable.
GTAC President Bill Williams says they'll continue to look at the data they've collected to see if they can make a mine a reality. Meanwhile, people living near the Pinokies are wondering how the region will move on with or without mining. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio in Superior.
I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More Central Time is coming up right after the news. Stay tuned.